From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In Honduras, a woman is murdered every 16 hours.
Nunca había visto tanta mujer asesinada como en este último año.
I've never seen so many women murdered as this year. Yes, women who have been assassinated. Their bodies show up in the rivers and the hills and the countryside.
We look at what's behind the violence against women in Honduras. Then we hear about how young Dominicans are making a style of accordion country music hip for the R&B and hip-hop generation.
First of all, once you hear típico, you're going to get up and dance. You know, that's like, I think that's like the típico message right there. It's a great music, it's a great sound, it's happy. People just love it.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. What exactly does self-censorship in the media look like? A new report has zeroed in on the effect of organized crime on the Mexican media. 55 journalists have been killed in the last 6 years, a period coinciding with the Mexican government's declared war on the drug cartels operating in the country. Mexico is now one of the most dangerous places in the world to be a journalist. While some 60,000 deaths have occurred overall, and almost all aspects of life in Mexico have been touched by drugs and violence, the report finds that it has had a particularly devastating effect on the media. Ana Arana co-authored the study. She's the director of the MEPI Foundation, an investigative journalism center based in Mexico City, and she joins us now by phone. Welcome to Latino USA, Ana.
Thank you.
So, Ana, aside from the deaths of the 41 journalists, what was the most disturbing thing that you found in your research about the effect of crime on Mexican media?
Well, basically, the story looks at regional media. But we really wanted to look at how the war on drugs was developing black news holes in several parts of the country. And the readers in the central larger cities did not really know what was going on until something really big happened. We had heard a lot of personal accounts from journalists who said, you know, in some cases like in Tamaulipas, which is probably 100% censorship almost, and the only stories that they do write on crime have to be approved by the organized crime group that operates there, or they actually occur in Texas.
So you're saying that the organized crime leaders will get in touch with journalists and discuss with them?
Well, tell them not to do certain things in certain towns, not all over. I mean, it's just like the level of penetration is different in different places.
But that you do have a level of penetration where you actually have these meetings? Where...
Well, in Tamaulipas, we've been told since 2010 that that has happened. And if you read the local paper, you never see anything pretty much related to the one group that controls certain towns in that state, because actually the state is now under dispute. Both groups that are pretty much more in control of that state, which is very important for Mexico-U.S. commerce, would tell the local press, you can write about this or you can't write about that. And reporters and editors have said that to us in 2010. This was a report where we looked at crime reporting in 2011. It's continued. So Tamaulipas has not changed.
Your reporting actually found that coverage of drug crime actually went up in 2011. It has stayed on the front pages, but you say that there's a problem. What is the problem, then, if the reporting has gone up?
Well, the reporting went up because violence went up in 2011 in several states. But if you look at the stories, which is what we did, there's no context, there's no follow-up in most cases. There's very little identification of who the victims are and what we think is the culprit in all of this, because we're trying to sort of find out why, what can you do. There's no tradition here of giving complete, accurate crime information to the regional media.
And finally, right now, the International Press Institute has declared Mexico the most dangerous country in the world in which to be a reporter. Ana Arana, I've known you for a long time. You're a fellow journalist. You practice mostly in the United States. But if this state of affairs continues in Mexico, what are the long-term effects of this on Mexico's media and on journalists?
Well, I think in a lot of states, people are not really engaging in what we know as good journalism. I mean, they're pretty much just going through the motions. And you cannot blame them. So I think it's going to go into a crisis. And so I don't think things will get better in the short run, but I hope to see some improvements. And I think when you ask for logical things like release more statistics, you know, give better statistics, and there's a battle here over that. We found Mexican journalists who would say, yes, we would like to have more figures. In Torreón, for instance, this one editor we talked to said, sometimes we get the figures from three different government officials, offices, and they all contradict each other. So you want more information, you want credible statistics, and you want it timely. You cannot come out with a report on an event that happened 6 months ago and present it in a place where every day there's some other atrocity happening.
Well, thanks for your work, Ana. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ana Arana is the director of the Fundación MEPI, based in Mexico City. She spoke to us by phone. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter, where we are LatinoUSA, all one word. And we are back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. So stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In the next few months, we'll be airing a series of reports on an extraordinary wave of violence facing women in Central America and Mexico. Our first report takes us to Honduras, the most violent country in the world, according to the UN, with the highest per capita homicide rate. So what's to blame? Poverty and unemployment contribute. So does drug trafficking. More than 70% of the cocaine coming into the U.S. passes through Honduras, and the situation got a lot worse after a coup in 2009 that ousted the democratically elected president, Manuel Zelaya. But we wanted to find out why women are so often the targets. It's Women's Day in Honduras, commemorating the day in 1955 when women here were given the right to vote. Several hundred women and a few men have gathered at the Parque Merced in downtown Tegucigalpa. The women in the park chant, "My body is not a battlefield." In Honduras, a woman is murdered every 16 hours. Most of the cases are unsolved. I'm sitting out of the sun under a large tree. As the music plays, a woman approaches me. She's carrying a large brown envelope.
¿Cómo es? Santos Amada Herrera.
What did you want us to know? You pulled us over here to tell us a story. What is the story you want us to know?
Okay, quiero poner una denuncia aquí aprovechando la oportunidad.
Santos Amada Herrera tells me her husband has battered her for more than 10 years. The envelope she carries is filled with medical records and legal papers. Her husband is a policeman. And Santos tells me she's gone to law enforcement agencies, but so far, they've been of little help.
He threatens me. He treats me badly. I have scars on my body that he caused. I have made complaints, even to the Supreme Court, but because he's a policeman, no one touches him.
I arrange to meet with Santos later, and she brings along her 7-year-old daughter, Betsy.
I've asked you if you could show me some of the scars of where you've been wounded. And your daughter is sitting right here. And you want to show us, even with your 7-year-old daughter present?
Sí, lo quiero hacer.
She's standing up now and she's opening up her pants in front of us and in front of her daughter. She's unbuttoning her pants. And she's pulling them down. And she's showing us ¿Qué pasó allí? What happened there? ¿Qué pasó allí?
Santos then shows me a poorly healed scar on her lower belly, close to her groin.
This is where he cut me with a knife. He would say, "I would cut you there so you will never again marry. I would never think of having another sexual partner for fear I'd hook up with another savage like him."
Do you think that there is any
institutional government support for a woman like you, an abused woman like you?
Pues si la hay, no la conozco. Porque nunca he visto una tan sola mujer.
If there is, I don't know. I don't know of any abused women that have been saved from violence. I've asked for help from the media, from authorities. I've showed my scars and bruises. This is embarrassing. They call him from the courts. All they've done is give him 2 months community service, but they've never jailed him.
Fue lo único que hicieron ahí. Entonces no hay una autoridad que esté pendiente de esas situaciones, máxime con ellos que imparten la ley en este país ahorita.
Santos says that since the 2009 coup, she and others have become more aware of the role of the police in perpetrating violence. The police are feeling very powerful right now. She says her husband told her that the current president, Porfirio Lobo, is not the one in charge. It's the police and the military who are calling the shots, she said.
Nos hemos dado cuenta de tantas realidades que el golpe de Estado no sirvió.
We know how it's the police who rob and kill and commit extortion. And if you say anything, you're dead. We saw this with the son of the university rector. A camera caught the police killing him. But I have no financial possibilities to have a video camera that will prove this is who killed me.
Y que pueda decir, este fue el que me mató.
Santos is referring to a high-profile case in which police were caught on camera killing the son of a university official. This case and others have brought to light that it's more than simple corruption or bribery that's ailing the country's police department. In Honduras, say many experts, the police are being used as a means of state-sponsored oppression of political enemies, with women often bearing the brunt of their violence.
You say that that you have noticed an increase in violence against women just in the last year. Why? And what have you seen?
Nunca había visto tanta mujer asesinada como en este último año.
I've never seen so many women murdered as this year. Yes, women who have been assassinated. Their bodies show up in the rivers and the hills in the countryside. A friend of mine went to complain against the police, and she was raped by them. You can imagine, if this is the way they treat me, who's the mother of his children, who cooks and cleans for him, how they would treat ordinary citizens. 1,319 here in Honduras. No one has any interest in getting to the bottom of what the police are doing.
Pero en Honduras nadie tiene el interés de investigar qué pasa con esta policía tan corrupta que tenemos nosotros. Queremos que la policía ya nunca más siga matando a la gente en Honduras.
We want this violence to stop, that the police stop attacking us.
Ya no más violencia. No tengo una mamá, un familiar que me ayude económicamente, y más sin embargo.
Then Santos tells me about what her husband, the policeman, has done to his own daughter. The sweet-faced 7-year-old named Betsy timidly describes attacks that she, too, has suffered.
Llegó mi papá, le pegó en el oído y mamá le dolía.
My dad came and he hit mom in the ear and it hurt her.
And what did you feel in those moments? ¿Y qué es lo que tú sentías en esos momentos?
Miedo.
On one occasion, Betsy says, her father ran his motorcycle into her and her mom.
She has a scar on her left arm that's about 4 inches long.
Another time when she was 4, Santos says, Betsy wound up in the hospital with a brain hemorrhage after her father beat her.
Ella tuvo un desgarre cerebral. La doctora decía, esta niña póngale milagro porque nadie.
The doctor said, you should name this girl Miracle because she shouldn't be alive after that blow to her head.
An organization in Honduras called the Committee of the Families of the Disappeared says that since the coup, more than 10,000 complaints of abuse by the police and military have been filed, and that very few have been acted on. A delegation of women Nobel Peace laureates visited Honduras this year. One of them was American Jody Williams, who organized an international campaign to end the use of landmines. In Honduras, Williams obtained an audience with the Justice Minister, Luis Alberto Rubí.
Ustedes están aquí porque el fin primordial es la impunidad. ¿Es así?
Rubí acknowledged the impunity that exists in his country.
Y el problema más, dos problemas graves que nosotros vemos para el combate a la impunidad es uno, la falta de investigación.
He said there are two challenges fighting this impunity.
One is the lack of resources. The other is a general disregard for the rule of law throughout the country. There should be an educational campaign to teach Hondurans to obey the law as a matter of course, not just in exceptional cases. It does no good for the Justice Department to punish people if people don't know they need to obey the law. Otherwise, we'll never get ahead.
Si la ley es para cumplirla por excepción, no por regla.
Before I leave Honduras, I meet another woman. She's a street vendor who won't give her name for fear of reprisals from the police.
Mi nombre no lo puedo dar, mamita, por temor a que me vayan a hacer algo.
Her face is badly swollen, her eyes black and blue. The woman says police beat her while trying to clear the streets of vendors.
Sí, es que nosotros tenemos puesto en la isla.
The police were trying to steal what you were trying to sell as a street vendor?
Sí. And soy madre soltera de cuatro hijos.
What happened when you went to make the when you went to the Department of Justice to complain about this?
Entré al Core 7, estuve con el forense, me revisó el forense y después el fiscal me dijo que no podía hacer nada contra ese caso.
The woman says she was told nothing could be done. The United States provides training and other assistance to the Honduran military and police. Earlier this year, some of those funds were withheld after an investigation found links between a national police chief and death squads in the 1980s. And more cuts are being considered. Last month, the U.S. learned that a teenager was shot and killed at a military checkpoint. The officer in charge was trained in the U.S. Meanwhile, Santos Herrera, the woman we met who was carrying a brown envelope, went before another judge and got no relief. Now she says she's trying to find out how she and her daughter can leave the country. Report on violence against women in Honduras was produced by Maria Martin. And for more information and a link to a report about violence against women in Honduras and to see photographs of the people we spoke to, go to latinousa.org. Coming up on Latino USA, making the accordion cool.
All my friends saw me playing accordion. They were like, wow, that's cool. He was, isn't it hard to play? I'm like, no, I learned. I love it now.
That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Accordions are everywhere in Latin America and also in Latino communities across the U.S. We're mapping out these pockets of squeeze box enthusiasts around the country in a new series we call Squeeze Play. In this first story, we visit New York City's Dominican community, where a traditional, high-energy style of merengue is having something of a resurgence. Marlon Bishop has our story.
When Edwin Torres was a kid growing up in Long Island, he asked his parents for a different kind of birthday present.
At 16, I said to my father, I want an accordion.
Not an Xbox or an electric guitar, an accordion.
No, I found it really cool to play an accordion. Come on, who else plays an accordion? So I started playing, and then everybody else, all my friends saw me playing accordion. They were like, wow, that's cool. Like, yo, isn't it hard to play? I'm like, no, I learned, and I love it now.
Edwin says some of his classmates called him a nerd. But what they didn't know is that in the world of Dominican típico music, playing the accordion makes you a total rock star. Today, Edwin is 21 and a rising talent. Here he is playing a song his grandfather wrote. Típico music started in the Dominican countryside, and it's the root of modern-day merengue. It's also known as perico ripiao, which literally means shredded parrot in Spanish. The name is said to come from a brothel in the Dominican Republic, where the music was supposedly played around a century ago. Since then, it's been performed at parties throughout the country. When Dominicans began immigrating to New York, they brought típico with them as the soundtrack for celebrations. A lot of traditional music can die out with assimilation, but the opposite has happened with típico. Today, it's more popular than ever, with more than a dozen bands performing at restaurants and clubs around the city every weekend. Edwin's band, the Ripiao Kings, is one of them. Fernando Guzman is the group's singer.
First of all, once you hear típico, you're going to get up and dance. You know, I think that's the típico message right there. You know, music is it's a great music. It's a great sound. It's happy. People just love it. Baby, let me love you now.
Fernando and Edwin were both handpicked for the Ripiao Kings by Ray Chinito Diaz, a veteran típico percussionist with a big idea. The concept is either revolutionary or sacrilegious, depending on who you talk to mix típico with U.S. pop music and draw in Dominican-American kids.
A lot of the followers are young, who listen to hip-hop and R&B and dance music and all that stuff. Plus, they like the típico, So I think if we can get those three or four sounds together, I think they might catch their ear.
Ladies, if you feel sexy, make some noise. Tonight, the Ripiao Kings are playing a late-night set at the Faro Lounge in Brooklyn. The place is filled with young Latinos dressed in streetwear and dancing to hip-hop and club music. Chinito is a little worried that it might not be the right crowd for the band.
I'm hoping that they'll like the típico, too, so... I'm sure there's some people I see that might like the típico. I don't know about some other guys, but...
Never fear. At 3 a.m., the band strikes up, and the clubgoers pair off. They dance the same hip-swinging two-step their parents and grandparents have done for more than 100 years. Edwin, the accordion player, is glad his generation likes típico, but he wants to see it go beyond the Dominican community and find broader commercial success, like Bachata did a decade ago. And he thinks the Ripiao Kings, with their hybrid sound, is the band to make it happen.
I know it can expand all over, because when people listen to the accordion sound, I think it like jumps at them. I know this is going to push out. I have the feeling in me. Like, you just have the feeling that it's going to push out.
If Edwin's right, we might see more kids skipping the Xbox and begging their parents to buy them accordions. For Latino USA, I'm Marlon Bishop.
This week marks the beginning of Hanukkah, the Jewish Festival of Lights. Trina Hernandez is a blogger from Austin, Texas, who brings us this essay about the holiday.
I don't do Christmas. People ask me, but aren't you Mexican? I say yes, but I'm Jewish. And what we celebrate at this time of year is Hanukkah. For years, my family had suspected there were Jews in our lineage. My father finally confirmed it through a rabbi he met, who showed him how to search the records to find the names of Jewish ancestors who fled Spain in 1492. He traced my mother's lineage to the same place. All those years I spent yawning in Catholic church with mi abuelita certainly didn't do me any harm. For years, Catholicism gave me and my family the foundation for believing. But hearing about our ancestry answered a lot of questions for me, like why I'd wanted to give my son a Jewish name, why didn't I like pork, and why I never liked Christmas. In my family, Christmas celebrations were once a grand event. We'd make tamales, crack jokes, and rip apart presents. But I always felt that we should have fun and be merry more than just once a year. My son was born the year I decided to quit Christmas for good. For the next 4 years, the holiday season in our house was calm and quiet. But last year, we celebrated our first Hanukkah. Hanukkah is a time of hope, a time for miracles, and a time to be thankful. These are concepts I want my son to be familiar with. His grandmother, my mother, taught him how to read the Hebrew alphabet and how to play the dreidel. We bought and lit our first menorah and said the prayers every night for 8 nights. Instead of the chaos I'd experienced at Christmas, I felt intimacy. Now, I eagerly await Hanukkah. My son enjoys getting presents for 8 nights, but he also understands it is an opportunity to give thanks to our Elohim, Yahweh, for making the impossible possible. So now, I'll choose latkes over tamales any day. Wait, no, I take that back. Tamales and latkes together. Now that's the stuff.
Trina Hernandez blogs regularly for Latino Metro in Austin, Texas. And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, call our listener line at 646-571-1228. That's 646-571-1228. Just tell us how to say your name clearly and where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We had additional production help this week from NPR in Washington, D.C., and additional engineering from Michael Johnson. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at MacFound.org, and the SCAN Foundation, committed to aging with dignity and independence at TheScanFoundation.org. This is NPR.